Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 58 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Friday, March 26, 2020. How are you feeling these days? If you're feeling up, down, or somewhere in between, hopefully by the time you finish this episode, you will feel encouraged in the great work you are doing. Later in the program, Dr. Anthony Leisowitz from Yale Climate Connections will share good news about a new tool that is helping 9 city neighborhoods address environmental injustices. And joining us in the Art House is Sarah Jaquette Ray, the author of A Field Guide to Climate Anxiety. Sarah will talk about the power of our imaginations and how to keep our cool on a warming planet. But first, let's talk about our feelings, especially our feelings around climate change. In particular, let's look at what young people are feeling about it and how they are learning about our rapidly changing climate. Meet Dr. Krista Heiser.
I'm a professor of composition and rhetoric at Kopi'olani Community College in Honolulu, Hawaii. I currently work for the UH system on a very interesting reassignment, director of the Center for Sustainability across the curriculum, working in the office of the Vice President for Academic Policy and Planning, and with the UH system Office of Sustainability.
Actually, Dr. Heiser joined us in the Art House for episode 51, Art and Identity. Krista gave excellent recommendations about climate fiction. Today, though, she's here to tell us what she has discovered about students and climate change. Her research uses focus groups, interviews, and reflective writing to learn more about student and faculty perspectives on climate change and sustainability. In addition to how students are feeling about climate change, the researchers were curious about how young people learn about climate in the first place. Are they getting what they need from their teachers and classes?
Students are learning about climate change from the world around them. They are seeing it with their own eyes. Beaches that they go to that look different, and then talking with family members about things they used to eat, places they used to go. So we were surprised that 19 and 20-year-olds would feel like they're seeing these changes, but that's what they reported to us. In fact, college faculty were just about the last most frequently mentioned source of climate change information. So it's the world around them, and then movies, documentaries, peers, friends, social media, of course, and then college faculty. So I was very interested in how do we shift that so that more students who are attending college are learning about climate change.
In a moment, you will hear some suggestions of how schools and universities can address this teaching and learning gap. There is a bigger piece of the puzzle we need to consider, though. This is the role of students' emotions when climate change is introduced into the classroom. Students' feelings can actually undermine their ability to understand and learn. Back in 2018, I first met Krista at her school in Honolulu. She had just begun meeting with students in these focus groups. As we sat in her office with a gorgeous view of the campus and the rich island vegetation, she told me about an eye-opening encounter she had with a student. This encounter led to her research project into students' emotions and climate change.
I think I first got this idea actually sitting right here in my office. And right where you are sitting right now, I had a student. He was actually from Hong Kong. And in my class, in English 100, we had read the book Man with the Compound Eyes. And this book is about sea level rise and trash, and basically trash gyre, the island, washes onto the shores in Taiwan. And he had read it in the original Chinese. And he sat in my office right where you're sitting, and he started to cry. And he said, "I don't understand why your class is the only class where I'm talking about this." This is like 5 years ago. This is before Greta Thunberg has brought our awareness to what it feels like to be a young person in this reality and not have your teachers meeting you where you're at emotionally.
The result was the Worry and Hope Study, which formed 18 groups with 150 students. The study was approved by the Institutional Review Board. In the study, they asked the students, what do you know, think, feel, and do about climate change? What does the research reveal?
We asked students, wow, we've been talking about all these things. How does this make you feel? And then analyzed 997 emotion utterances, coded those emotion utterances, and then grouped the emotions into more generalized emotions. And we came up with this pie chart that illustrates those student emotions, and they are anger, fear, sadness, shame, and hope. This pie chart has been so interesting for lots of faculty across the country. We've presented it at a couple different conferences, and it's basically data that shows what teachers already knew. It never had been really presented in a data set for them. This is stuff they already knew and had seen these emotions, but now we could really talk about how do we meet these emotions in a discussion in a college classroom. A couple people have actually replicated the questions. There was someone at University of Michigan who took our focus group protocol and replicated it in a survey and asked students at University of Michigan the same questions. His analysis showed almost the same spread of emotions: fear, anger, sadness, shame, and hope.
No surprise, this is how young people feel. In fact, many adults feel similarly. When we share information about climate change, we do well to consider the emotional needs of those hearing our message.
If we're not engaging with these emotions, then the students are not actually learning. There's something about the teaching of climate change that doesn't always stick, particularly between high school and college. Climate science and climate change impacts is part of, say, the Common Core in the K-12 curriculum. It's something that they're supposed to have learned and covered, but it doesn't seem to me like it necessarily sticks. Students learn it. They'll even say, I've learned about the greenhouse effect so many times, but could you explain it one more time? They sort of understand it, but they don't feel very confident about their understanding. And so if we're not engaging the emotional body, then they're not actually learning it.
Having this data has opened up a set of discussions about best practices, techniques, and approaches educators can use to better reach their students. Connecting with peers around the USA and looking at various teaching theories and practices, Krista and fellow researchers are on a quest to discover or rediscover the methods that will help students learn about climate change.
The publication where we'll be sharing this work in the Journal of Community Engaged Scholarship is a special issue on climate change and knowledge translation. I had to learn what knowledge translation is all about, which is a whole interesting field. And I learned there this idea of knowledge brokering. And that's really what faculty are doing, knowledge brokering. I learned something about, say, climate science or glacial melt or methane bubbles or something. I learn about it, and then I'm choosing what to represent and share to my students and how to do that. All knowledge is brokered knowledge. And that's really the role that faculty are in. And so in the knowledge translation literature, I came across the work of Michael Polanyi in the 1960s. And Polanyi had identified this implicit knowledge that he called an indwelling. I'm in love with this word, the indwelling. And that's the feeling of it. You can learn something in your mind, but if you don't create an indwelling for that information, it doesn't stay. This is called head, heart, hands work. There's lots of different frameworks for this, but I just really love that word of how do we create the indwelling for climate information.
To create the conditions needed to facilitate this indwelling of knowledge, Krista suggests we break out of traditional styles of presentation.
We've got to stop teaching climate change in a PowerPoint. Even though so much information can be presented that way, how do we present it in discussion, in dialogue, in art, in experiential ways, so that students can really internalize it?
Now, as people who talk a lot about climate change, we have our own feelings that bubble up. While being transparent about our own emotions might seem like a good way to help students and others get in touch with their own, Krista suggests we consider holding back on sharing our own feelings and instead make room for students to get in touch with their own first.
What we're finding that faculty need to be cultivating is a way to learn a skill set to hold space for different emotions. So I learned about subconscious mirroring. If I'm teaching the class or leading a conversation with a group and I express my, let's say, sadness, there's a subconscious mechanism where the student wants to help me feel better. As humans, we want to make the other person feel better. So if I'm showing my sadness, that deprives them of their sadness. I think I'm being vulnerable and showing them, you know, how I feel, which can be good. But we need to learn how to hold space for students to have these emotions.
Students need more than to comprehend the science behind climate change. The scope of the issue extends well beyond the world of science. In fact, Krista advocates that climate change instruction be liberated from the sciences into all aspects of instruction in our schools.
It's a new aspect of the faculty role that I think we're looking at. My main takeaway from the research is that teaching climate change is everybody's academic discipline. It's everybody's responsibility. We all carry like a little piece of it. When students get a little piece from me and a little piece from a science teacher and another piece from a philosopher and another piece from even their math teacher, this is how they create that indwelling and create their understanding that's going to sustain them through their lifetime. College students, these are young people, 19, 20, 25 years old, and we're giving them the foundation of how they're going to understand this changing world and the knowledge that's going to sustain them and the ways of thinking that are going to help them adapt and respond to this. So it's really very, very important work.
Young people are seeing climate change firsthand, yet they get mixed messages.
So we talk about cognitive dissonance a lot, and in the context of this work, what I mean by cognitive dissonance is when what you're learning in the classroom doesn't mirror or reflect what's going on in our crazy world right now. You know what I mean? Like if there's a mismatch.
In a class, they may learn about the overwhelming amount of plastic pollution in the world. Then after class, as they walk around campus, free plastic keychains, frisbees, and desk organizers.
That's what we mean in this work by cognitive dissonance. We just wanted to flip that around and think, how could we create greater cognitive resonance? Dissonance is what leads to anxiety, and resonance is what leads to indwelling, right? Is what leads to empowerment and hopefulness. Little things can create cognitive resonance. If we were on campus, when students can see things like composting food in the cafeteria or not having plastic water bottles, those type of campus sustainability efforts, they really matter because they support cognitive resonance. They show a change is occurring.
To find out more about Dr. Krista Heiser's work and her ongoing learning, she created the Teaching Climate Change Field Note blogs.
So Field Notes is a part of a qualitative research method. It's about thinking and processing the conversations and interviews that you're doing. It's sort of like thinking out loud in my blog. I think about what I'm thinking and what I'm reading and how it intersects with the fascinating interview subjects that I'm interviewing.
Visit teachingclimatechange.medium.com. That's teachingclimatechange.medium.com. I have links to Dr. Heiser's blog and the study in our show notes. Now it is time for the Art House. Sarah Chiquette Ray is a professor of environmental studies, a writer, and a mom. She doesn't necessarily see herself as an artist. In taking on climate change, though, she recognizes the essential role of the arts.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to make the case to me how important art is in this. And I think people often think that because of the urgency of the moment, we can bypass a lot of the kind of creative effort and the imaginative work and the visionary work that we need to do. But Donella Meadows and all kinds of huge environmental thinkers in the past have always claimed that the imagination and the vision is the necessary groundwork on which to build anything in the first place. We do need to really slow down to do that work. The urgency narrative of this moment also makes it easy to sidestep issues like social justice, kind of default to the dominant or majority voice in the room just so we can get some decisions made and get moving. There's a real danger to that. I do criticize the urgency narrative of most mainstream environmental arguments about our moment.
On Earth Day 2020, in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, she published a book that is helping people navigate their strong feelings about climate change.
Yeah, my book is called A Field Guide to Climate Anxiety, How to Keep Your Cool on a Warming Planet. The basic premise of the book is drawn from my experience with students teaching environmental studies classes for the last 10 or 11 years. In the first 5 or 6 years of teaching, they would learn the information, get all pumped out and go out and get careers and whatever. It was not a really big deal. But in the last 5 or 6 years of teaching, I've noticed that students' despair and emotional response to the material was really getting in their way to even complete college or come to classes. And it was sort of taking up all the space in the classroom. If I wanted to actually turn these students into the sort of citizens and leaders of environmental change in the future that I proclaimed that we would do, they were going to need to have much more emotional and existential and psychological attention to how the material was being presented and processing it for them. Turned all my research towards thinking about what psychologically we all need to engage in work for the long term. So I translated that into kind of a book for the climate generation. It doesn't have to be read in order, and anything that is cumulatively built into there gets kind of repeated again as needed in short form, just so that people don't have to feel like they have to sit down and read through a whole book. I wanted it to at least feel like it was an accessible, informal experience to just kind of spend some time with a few pages at a time and not feel like they had to follow the story from the beginning to the end.
Reading Sarah's book, I saw how the concepts she covers are not just helpful for students in high school and college. They're the questions and issues artists who are engaged in climate work consider all the time. For storytellers, Sarah suggests we adjust the lens of how we look at climate stories. Telling the stories that will have the most impact takes real work.
If we think about how media frames everything in the negative frame, and that the media actually covers increasingly more and more just negative news because of the constraints of the way media is being produced in this day and age. And if we think about that combined with our kind of reptilian brains that want to focus and have a negativity bias towards the negative, that's a kind of a killer cocktail for thinking only about the world going up in flames. Living in that story of the world spiraling into chaos or spiraling into doom creates a emotional ecosystem in our lives that's really not conducive to action or empowerment or positive impact on the world. it's not that the bad things aren't happening, but that the vast majority of the media that we consume is only about the bad things. It's super difficult for media to tell stories about the good things that are going on, because the good stories, the stories of slow change and slow hope, don't fit the narrative frames of dominant media. Telling those stories that are really incremental and slow is very challenging for media, and so we don't see much of it. And therefore, it takes actual work, and it's a discipline of the mind to seek out stories of solutions happening. But what happens when we focus on the stories of solution, what happens when we surround ourselves in all of the examples of positive change, it's not that we, you know, sit back on our laurels and say, oh, everybody's got this covered, I don't have to do anything, which is what one might think. People don't like to tell positive stories in part because they think it will stop people from acting. It will make people feel like there's no point in doing anything. But on the contrary, psychology shows that stories of people successfully doing good things in the world generates more people wanting to do good things, and it makes us feel more like doing good things.
For artists engaged in community-based projects, especially in the current political climate in the USA, Sarah encourages relationship building.
Given the divisiveness that's been happening in the country for some time now, and because so many of my students really get hung up on not being able to talk to their parents and family members and friends back home about the things that they're learning in college, I started to pivot a lot of my teaching away from trying to arm students with more and better and stronger arguments to defend their position on some sort of rhetorical soapbox when they go out and argue in the world, and more around making sure that they can cultivate good relationships with people, and that being in relationship with each other and being in relationship with people who are different from you and have different politics than you, and also with the more than human world, is actually the foundation for the kind of changes that we need to see. And so if I was going to change my own thinking about that, I was going to have to change my own teaching around that. What would it mean to center my assignments and my curriculum around relationship building instead of content delivery? Social capital and community trust is far more effective at having communities bounce back from a disaster, for example, than anything like infrastructure or other kinds of emergency band-aid fixes on a problem. If we start to think about cultivating relationship and trust as the primary solution to our problems, it changes things.
The role of imagination is vital for envisioning a successful future. So many young people, though, feel overwhelmed by bad news. Sarah witnessed how much they struggled in one of her classes.
I didn't realize how important the imagination was until I did an exercise with my students that I had been a subject of in a different workshop. Close your eyes and, you know, really kind of do this vision exercise where they visualize themselves 10 years from now or 20 years from now. When somebody comes up to them and thanks them for all of the things that they've done to bring about this wonderful world that they live in, I ask them to think deeply about what is it that they would have done? What it was their, what was a sort of breakthrough moment that they realized that they had contributed or intervened or made a big difference in creating a positive future? I thought I was getting all, you know, deep with my students, and I asked them to open their eyes and share back what happened. What did they do? You know, what were they being thanked for? And my students could not respond. And finally, they said to me, well, we just couldn't imagine a future. And I thought, well, that's really, you know, that's really lazy of you. I thought to myself, are you just not stepping up to the plate? You can't imagine your future. What kind of weaklings are you? You know, or I was mad. Actually, it didn't take long for them to explain that, in fact, that the reason why they weren't able to imagine the future was because it was just too hard to look at. There wasn't maybe a future that they could imagine wanting. There were two students in the class that day, and they could imagine a future, and they had the radical imagination. And they looked around at their peers, and they were so horrified and so heartbroken that they actually turned their career goals around fostering and creating and generating a radical imagination. And they've been producing artwork and various other things since. And to realize how essential it is to imagine the future, there's no way that future is going to happen, that positive future is going to happen, if we can't imagine it. The not being able to imagine it is a result of the stories we've been consuming about how terrible things are. Adrienne Marie Brown asked the question, what would it take to imagine living and thriving in a climate change future rather than fearing it? What would it take to desire that future rather than fear it? And that was really a turning point for me. We're not going to have this future. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. We won't have this positive future if the despair about it's possibly being terrible causes us to not do anything in the first place.
Finally, Sarah strongly urges her readers and her students to be mindful of their own needs. While tending to the wider world, do not overlook self-care.
The environment and the planet are not actually going to be helped by us disciplining and punishing ourselves to the point of not existing. The environment and the planet need us to actually thrive so that we can engage in this work and create the community to continue to do that. That kind of thriving, as most other social movements know, starts with self-preservation. And so if I wake up every single day and ask myself, what is it that I want to grow today? It really helps me focus on manifesting that little micro utopia that is the point of all the work that we're doing anyway in my day, into my sort of immediate moment. The more we can do that, the more uplifted we'll be, the more success we'll feel, the more immediate sense of purpose we'll feel, and the more we're going to find a lot of other people who are doing the same thing. And there is nothing more joyful and hopeful than working on a collective goal in a collectivity. Our resilience and our ability to have thriving and have daily well-being and notice beauty and tend to the things that we love and all the other stuff that I write about in the book is basically impossible if all of our hormones and chemicals are not doing that help for us. And there's a certain amount of that we can control, not all of it for sure, but a certain amount of our dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, you know, endorphin levels we have control over, and emotions are connected to chemicals in our body. So, you know, at the level of our body, we need to be making sure that we are healing from trauma, that we need to do that work on ourselves to make sure we're as resourced as we possibly can to act from a place of abundance and do the work that we need to do. The name of the book is called A Field Guide to Climate Anxiety, How to Keep Your Cool on a Warming Planet. And the book can be purchased at the University of California Press's webpage, or you can purchase the book through my local bookstores, Northtown Books or Eureka Books, and all of the proceeds from those purchases, which can be delivered, mailed to you, or picked up at the bookstore, those will all be donated to those local bookstores. You can follow me on Twitter at S. Jaquette Ray, that's S-J-A-Q-U-E-T-T-E-R-A-Y. Or my website is sarahjaquetteray.com. Of course, I have a Facebook page for the book, A Field Guide to Climate Anxiety.
If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me by email, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Before we end our show, we have good news to share. Well, it is hopefully the beginning of better news for communities that experience environmental injustice.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Some city neighborhoods are lush with parks and trees, but others are dominated by treeless stretches of concrete and pavement. Areas with fewer trees to provide shade and less vegetation to soak up water,
they tend to be hotter, they tend to be wetter, they tend to have worse air quality.
Kate Mingoy is with Groundwork USA, a network of environmental justice organizations. She says these disparities result from decades of disinvestment and redlining, racist mortgage lending policies that reinforced segregation and worsened inequality. Groundwork is helping residents in 9 cities highlight the relationship between historical segregation and climate change vulnerability.
Without a really clear understanding of the harms that have happened in the past, you can't have a vision for the future and for how you're going to repair that harm.
The group overlaid maps of historical redlining with data about heat, tree cover, and impermeable surfaces. Mingoya says the maps show how the impacts of redlining persist and provide an important tool for local residents
to sit down with their local government, with elected officials, with leaders in their community and say, you need to explain why this is still the case and you need to explain what you're going to do to make things look a little bit different.
That report was made possible through a collaboration with Yale Climate Connections. Thank you for joining me for episode 58 of Citizens Climate Radio. This show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Mortarano, Flannery Winchester, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.